This week's parsha is Parshat Balak. The nations were given a prophet. Balak ben Zippor is the king. The prophet is Bilam. His father, Beor, was a prophet. And in our parsha, we learn how Balak summons Bilam to curse Israel. And even though he offers seven sacrifices each time Bilam surprises him with a greater blessing of Israel, until finally Bilam says, whoever curses him should be cursed. And Balak gets very upset. He says, if you didn't, I invited you to curse my enemies, and here you blessed them three times. Get out of here, run back to the place you came from. And Bilam says, oh, let me tell you. And then he goes on to give him another prophecy that speaks about how Israel will ultimately be the ultimate power in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, I wish I would have an end like them. And then Bilam says, let me give you some advice about how they're going to finish off your nation at the end of time. And then he tells him, but if you want to take them down, Elokeihem shel eilu sonezima, the God of these people, he hates promiscuity. You want to make them fall? The way to do it is send girls out there, get them to sin with the girls, and then God will be upset with them, which is exactly what he does. And at the end of the parasha, there's this massive plague. Jews are dropping like flies, and it's all because the Jews have intermarried. They have cheated on their wives. They've gone out to the tents of these Moabite and Midianite girls who have come out to seduce them. And it reaches the point where the head of the tribe of Shimon, Zimri ben Salu, goes out with a Midianite princess, and Pinchas, who is Moshe's nephew's son, right? He is the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. Pinchas says, Moshe, doesn't he deserve the death penalty? And Moshe says, he's all yours. And Pinchas runs up and kills Zimri together with Cozbi. And with that, the plague stops, and our parsha ends with 24,000 Jews dead. Massive number. Now we begin our parsha. That was just an overview. So, our parsha really begins a long time ago, a long time before our parsha. There were wars. And in those wars, Sihon has taken swaths of territory from Moab. And the truth is that our parsha begins long before that. We need a bit of background. In order to understand our parsha, we need a little bit of background. In Israel, you have 30 kings. That means kings in those days were like governors. You had very small kingdoms in Israel. And when you look at the area of the Middle East, you have many small kingdoms. Now, let's go back a stage. We have the flood. Adam, 10 generations, Noah, the flood, and humanity starts again. Now, Noah has children who will settle lands. So if we look at Parshas Noach, we see the 70 nations. Because as we count the children of Noach's children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, one of the wonderful things Moshe did for the world was tell us the genealogy dating back to Noach. So he tells us Ashkenaz, the father of all of Germany, Tzorfat, the father of all French. He tells us where these people descended from. Now, obviously, you had tribes, you had movements, you had wars, you had the Germanic tribes invading. That's true. But you also have a certain genealogy. Each of you can take a pamphlet here. We're going to look.
Is Tzorfat in the Bible? Tzorfat? Like that was the guy? Wow.
And Ashkenaz.
Ashkenaz verifat v'togarma bnei Yavan Elisha v'tarshish kitim v'dodanim. So you have a man named Yavan, you have a man named Greece. Now all the kingdoms surrounding Israel were pretty small, and if you look around what you start realizing is that the kingdoms, if we talk about Ammon, Moab, where did Ammon and Moab begin? They began 10 generations later, because the descendants of Noah, remember, Noah has a grandson named Canaan. So the Canaanites began a generation after the flood. But the other nations like Ammon, Moab, Amalek, they only begin with the generation of Avram. Remember, Avram is 10 generations after Noah. So the nations that were direct descendants of Noah had a 10 generation head start. So the nations, for example, of Canaan were all 10 generations older. That means they were double the age. 10 generations as opposed to 20 generations made them much, much larger. Ammon, Moab, well, they just began with Lot. Remember, Lot had a son named Ammon. He had a son named Moab. So that's a nation that's beginning at the same stage as Yitzchak, right? As Avram's son. Now that means they've only had 4 or 5 generations to develop these nations. Think about it. Ammon and Moab were the same generation as Yitzchak. Yitzchak has a grandson named Levi, who has a grandson named Amram, who's Moshe's father. So 4 generations from Yitzchak, you're beholding by Moshe Rabbeinu. So if we have a parallel in the nation of Ammon and Moab, that they parallel genealogically with Yitzchak, they've only had 4 generations to develop. How big can they be? Let's assume there are tribes that join them. So as we began, the nations around Israel were pretty small. Ammon, Moab, Amalek, again another nation that began very late. Amalek, and even though they joined with Seir, they were still pretty small. So you have small tribes around here. You go back to Aramean territory, Aram, you have bigger nations. And Israel comes on the scene and they're huge. They number 2 million. They're coming through the desert and they're very scary. And then when they come up against Sihon and Og, who are the larger nations, the more powerful nations, and they just wipe them off the map, so then everyone starts getting really scared. Remember, Mitzrayim was an ancient nation because Noah's grandson was named Mitzrayim. Noah had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet, and Ham had a son named Mitzrayim. Yefet had a son named Yavan, Greece. So Greece is a nation that's been developing all the way since Noah. But Mitzrayim's been developing since Noah. Israel is new on the map. We've only started 12 generations later with Yaakov Avinu. So we're a smaller people. And yet we've grown tremendously in Egypt. We come out and there are 2 million Jews. According to the Medrash, there were another 2 million Egyptians that joined us. The Erev Rav, according to the Medrash, could be even outnumbered the Jews, the number of Egyptians that joined us when we left Egypt. The Medrash has conflicting opinions about how many joined us. So there's this huge nation coming through the desert. And they have miracles. It's abnormal that they could exist for 40 years in the desert. Now, before we continue, let's just pause to get historical perspective. There are 3 major times in world history where there was a great revolution militarily and also politically. The first one happened with the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire was larger than anything the Middle East had ever seen beforehand. And that's why Sanherib, the king of Ashur, was able to devour the other kings. They just couldn't stand up to him. When he came in with his military might, no one could do anything. He just swooped through the land as he tells the Judean king. He says, I have enough horses. My little battalion that I sent to take you down, I can give you a horse for every soldier you have. And your rivers, I can just cross them with my army, and they'll just dry out. There will be no Jordan. I will dry out your rivers just with the footsteps of my horses. And he's not exaggerating. The Assyrian Empire, today we know this archaeologically, but the Talmud said this long before the archaeologists discovered this. They were an empire that was more powerful than anything that had been seen in the region until that time. So when the Assyrian Empire comes and then evolves into the Babylonian Empire, we hear different angles of how that happened, but they evolved into the Babylonian Empire, which was a phenomenal army. That's the first time. The second time, the world saw massive revolution and innovations in a phenomenal empire that had military might like nothing they'd seen before, is the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, the Roman fighting machine, was so organized, as Josephus writes, no one had the engineers like the Roman Empire. Their troops were so well trained that you just couldn't stand up to them. There was no army that existed that was as well trained as them. And they were so powerful that no one could imagine that they'd ever lose. It was beyond anyone's dreams that the Roman Empire would ever fall, because they had such might, such order, they had such an organized legal system. Everything seemed to just function methodically and succeed. When they'd go to war, they'd have their engineers, and their engineers would analyze everything. Every battalion had a series of engineers. They didn't just go to war, everything was planned, arranged. Very different than any other country before the Roman Empire. And the third time we have such a thing is the German Empire. The German Empire, you know that Poland was conquered in a day, right? The nations were on a different playing field when the German Empire came to the scene. When they came to the scene, the nations couldn't stand up to them because they didn't even have, you know, the Polish sent out horses to fight the German tanks. It was a joke. Saying the Germans showed up with tanks and the Poles showed up with horses. Okay, go win that war.
So what was about Alexander the Great?
Alexander was the lead-in into the Roman, but you're right, Alexander, that's another great innovation. And
he was mainly strategic insight.
Alexander succeeded. I don't know about Alexander's innovations in the... These kingdoms, our tradition is that whenever there was a nation that was going to take over Israel, Hashem made them awesome. The pasuk says, "Ve'halevanon, ve'adir yipol." Lebanon must fall at the hands of the awesome. And so it wasn't one of our neighboring nations that just came in and won a war and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. It was an empire like something we'd never seen before. Be it the Assyrian Babylonian, be it the Roman, and what we saw with the German Empire was also something we've never seen before. That type of might. Coming back to our parsha, Israel was extraordinary. Israel was coming through the desert and everyone got scared. And the neighboring nations were paying taxes to Sihon and Og, protection money. When the Jews come, you'll stand up to them. And now Sihon and Og were just wiped out. So the smaller nations, Ammon, Moab, they got very worried. And if you look at the map, you can see that we basically passed Ammon without conquering them. So Ammon was less concerned. We just went right by them, conquered everything else, and left them alone. But Moab was thinking, hey, maybe they're going to continue southward. And as a matter of fact, against Moab, we started laying ambushes and doing guerrilla warfare. And although we did not have outright war with them, we were bothering them. So Moab gets worried. And Moab goes out to hire a king. And they take a king named Balak ben Zippor, who wasn't even a Moabite. They hire him. They haven't had a king because they were always subservient to Sihon. They were always under Sihon's thumb. So now, suddenly, they need a king. they heard of this great warrior named Balak, so they appoint him as king. They look at the nation of Israel, and they're very scared, because the nation of Israel, kiravu, they were awesome in number. Suddenly they see millions and millions of people. As far as they can see, they see Jews. They got very scared. So Moab is very worried, and Balak has to do something about it. So Balak says, our recent war against Sihon, we lost. Sihon hired the sorcerer Bilam to curse us. So the Moabites lost because Sihon had hired Bilam. Well, we should hire Bilam, and then maybe we'll be able to beat the Jews. So they joined forces with the Midianites. The Midianites were also a nation that was newly freed, that had been subservient to Sihon. If we look on our maps, Midian is further east. They don't show up on the first map. You guys found the map with Midian? Well, Midian is to the east. I don't see it on any of these maps. I have to upgrade, get more maps. Midian is to the east. And Moab sends word to Midian and says, let's go together and find out from Bilam what we should do. Maybe he can help us. They come to Bilam. They come to Bilam. And they ask Bilam, can you come? It's there? No, Midianite. And what does Bilam tell them? He says, stay overnight, and I'll tell you tomorrow what God tells me. So the Midianite said, oh, you're asking the God of the Jews? So never mind. And they leave. They say, he's like their father. Never heard of a father who wanted to curse his son. So they leave. You guys learn Rashi on the Parsha or not yet? So Rashi says, they did their own sorcery and they said, if he can answer us when we walk in, then he's going to assist us. And if he says, wait till tomorrow, then he can't assist us. So the Midianites left for whichever one of those three reasons. And Hashem shows up to Bilam. Now, when Hashem appears to someone, one of the challenges is that we don't know what Hashem's thinking. Prophets don't either know what Hashem's thinking. We don't know how Hashem works. Prophets also don't know how Hashem works. They know better than we do, but they still don't know how Hashem works. It's evident throughout the prophets. So Hashem asks Bilam, who are these men that came to you? Who are these men with you? So Bilam says, could be in your eyes, I'm not so important. But down here on earth, I'm very important. The king Balak, he sent to ask me, that nation coming out of Egypt, they're spreading out. Please, I should go curse them so that he can fight them and chase them out of the land. So Hashem tells Bilam, don't go. Bilam says, okay, can I curse them from here? Hashem says, don't curse them. Bilam says, let me bless them. Hashem says, they're blessed. They don't need your blessings. So Bilam forces himself out of bed the next morning. And he says, go back to your land. God doesn't let me go with you guys. And his indication is, you're not honorable enough. God is worried about my honor. If Balak only sent people like you, then I'm not allowed to go. Why doesn't Hashem let Bilam go? So, one interpretation is that God knew that in due time we would naturally be seduced by the girls of the Moabites and Midianites, and that we would be punished for it. And Hashem didn't want us and the Midianites and the Moabites to think it was all because of Bilaam. So Hashem says, don't go, I don't want you to curse him. We see in the end Hashem let him go. That's another story we'll have to discuss. But initially Hashem says, I don't want you to go. So Balak plays games. Bilaam plays games. He plays games with Hashem. He talks to Hashem, informing him how great he is. And he plays games with Balak, also informing him how great he is.
Hashem says Balak is great?
No.
Who said?
Bilaam is busy telling everyone how great he is, including Hashem. So, we have to ask ourselves why... where does this arrogance come from? Why do people feel it necessary to tell other people how great they are? Why is that important? What trait are we learning from Bilaam? The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avot that there are two opposites in the world. The Mishnah says one is Bilaam, and the antithesis of Bilaam is Avraham Avinu.
Oh, yeah?
It says... Okay, it's a good thing you came tonight. The Mishnah says there are students of Avraham Avinu and students of Bilaam. When Avraham Avinu could have wealth, Avraham Avinu says, I don't want a shoestring. When Bilaam is being asked for help, Bilaam says, well, I don't know if you could pay me enough. When Avraham Avinu speaks to the Ribon Shel Olam, he says, I am but dust, I am ash. I am nothing. When Bilaam speaks to the Ribon Shalom, he says, you might not realize how great I am, God. But down here, people really appreciate me.
Kind of a big deal.
So there's this huge par between Avraham and Bilaam. Avraham hears that his arch enemies, these people who are the epitome of evil, the people of Sodom and Amorah, are going to die. So Avraham runs to plead with God. Wait, maybe there are still good people among them. Bilaam hears that there are good, kind people who are trusted servants of Hashem coming out of Mitzrayim. And Bilaam says, oh, let me find a way to make them fall. Let me find a way to get them out. Wait, we have to notice the opposite sides between Bilaam and Avraham Avinu. And we have to realize that much of those two extremities exist within us. Meaning, the Mishnah says we have to desire, we have to try and train ourselves to be disciples of Avraham Avinu. A person wants to be a student of Avraham. Who's your Rebbe? Avraham Avinu. I once had a... I once had a meeting out in Yad Binyamin. And in those days, Rav Aaron Alevi used to live in Yad Binyamin. So I called him up and I asked him for directions to the place I was supposed to meet. And he told me, you get off at the entrance to the yeshuv, and then you have a nice long walk. It was hot summer day, something like today. So he says to me, call me. I don't live far from the bus stop. Call me and when you show up to Yad Binyamin. Okay. I showed up to Yad Binyamin. I give him a call. And a minute later, he shows up at the bus stop. He says, when's your meeting? I said, in 25 minutes. He said, good. Takes me to his house. Let me drink. Took out some grapes. Watermelon, I'm going to an important meeting, so first I should have something nice to eat. I should walk in refreshed. I come from his beautiful home. He drives me straight to the place of the meeting, and I walked in like a different human being. Had I walked from the bus stop in the heat, I would have shown up drenched, wiped from the journey. So as he drops me off, he says, call me up when the meeting's over. I'll take you back to the bus stop. I said to him, you know, your grandfather would be proud. He says, you know my grandfather? I said, sure. Your grandfather Avram Avinu would be proud. That's Achnasas Archim. I came from afar and you helped me out. We have to aspire to be students of Avram Avinu, the Mishnah says. So as we learn the Parsha and we hear Bilam's behavior, we have to realize there's a potential of that in us. The Parsha is teaching us something. The choices we make. Avram Avinu ensures that his cattle is fed before he sits down to eat. We see that from his servant. When a servant shows up by Eliezer, they offer him to eat. He says, wait, let's first give the cattle. They've been traveling. They've been carrying me all day. So he takes Teven Umispo, he takes the hay to feed the cattle before he's going to sit down to eat. We're about to see how Bilam behaves to his cattle. Avram Avinu never takes time to admire the beauty of his wife because his relationship with her is not about the physical. So years after they're married, decades after they're married, he says, you know, I noticed you're beautiful. She's 90 years old or 80, she's 65 years old. They've been married for decades. And he says, I just noticed you're very beautiful. Our sages say, how did he notice? He was about to cross the river and he looked down and he saw her reflection in the river. He wasn't ready for it. He looked, said, wow. Turned around and said, gee, I just want you to know. Yes. No, I'm sorry. I was bringing this because we are about to see that Bilam doesn't have a wife. Bilam at night goes to lie with his donkey. His intimacy is with the donkey. Does not... Yeah.
It's in the Torah, it says this?
Yeah.
In the written Torah?
It says the donkey asked him, Ha-haskein hiskanti. And the word haskein hiskanti can be interpreted in many ways. One of the ways that our sages said to interpret it is from the word sochenet. Sochenet is a woman that's hired to keep a man warm. Now we understand? Yes, sir.
So you say, the Lord is, Bilam is the opposite of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? And you say Bilam is the opposite of Moshe.
I didn't say that.
Of Avraham Avinu.
Yes.
The way there's also like a comparison where in the morning he takes his donkey.
Right.
If you read in the Haydah, Avraham did the same thing as well.
Right.
So is that why they also like they also have like the same traits a little bit?
No, Bilam we will see rushes to take his donkey to do evil.
Was it Avram, a good donkey or was it a boy donkey?
Bilam rushes to do the will of Hashem, to go against the will of Hashem. We'll get to that. When Hashem tells Avraham about the Akedah, he says, Kach na, can you please take? Which is a way of saying, you could tell me no, but I'm telling you what I want you to do. So Avraham understands the will of Hashem and says, if that's your will, I'm prepared to do it. Bilam understands the will of Hashem, but he's going to push and push and push until he could find a way to do what he thinks, what he wants. And then he's going to rush the next morning, the same way Avram rushed against what he wanted to do the will of Hashem. Bilam rushes to do what he wants against the will of Hashem. So it's not a comparison to show how similar they are. On the contrary, when the pasuk uses the same wording to show us how Bilam rushes, so our sages say, Sin'ah mekalkelet et ashua. Hatred destroys the way we behave, destroys our normal etiquette. Ordinarily, Bilam should have had his servants prepare the donkey. No, he rushes to do it himself. He hates the Jews so much. Avram Avinu rushes to saddle his donkey. Ordinarily, he should have had the servants do it. But if Hashem wants him to do it, he rushes because he wants to do the will of Hashem. Yes?
You say Bilam asked God to curse people from his house. He said, can I do it from here? But I thought he didn't have his powers and his great wisdom because he had to actually see what he
that was would doing. Help. That it wasn't that he couldn't do it without it. It was more effective when he could see.
So it would work sometimes and it would work sometimes?
Oh, we'll get there. We're not yet up to discussing what Bilam can and cannot do. That's another discussion.
Can you put this recording stuff away for my next question?
Yes. The question was asked, in Bilam's stature and wealth, why would he have relations with his donkey? So, marriage, or any relationship with a fellow human, involves giving and taking. Not only taking, you gotta give. There's a certain amount to give, you gotta give. And with the donkey, so he does whatever he wants. There's no talking back, unless, of course, it's Bilam's donkey. So in that sense, Bilam was... This is another reflection of where Chazal taught us how much Bilam was into life only for himself. Even in intimacy, which should be an act of love, he is not showing his love to anyone else. He is purely doing things for his own benefit. On a deeper level, we have a whole class, if you'd like to access it online, and if you guys want, then this Thursday night we could do it. There is a long commentary here about how one can sell their soul to the devil. And there's a way to do it.
Why would we need to know this?
You don't. That's why I'm not teaching you. Haha. But one of the things that a person does when they sell their soul to the devil is be intimate with a donkey. It is one of the ways that a person, so to speak, shows that they are, their soul is sold to the devil. But that's, you know, after a whole long procession, which we discussed at length, one year the guys all voted to do it, so we learned that whole medrash. It's online. It's online twice. We did it twice.
But I have a question for you. What does that help if the devil is somebody who works for Hashem?
It's a great question. Maybe Thursday night we can get to it. Let's move on with the parasha. So,
I don't think I'll be able to think about anything else now, Rabbi.
So, Balak gets this message. Bilam refuses to come with us. And so Balak sends a much bigger delegation with more honorable nobles. And they come to Bilam and they say, Balak said to tell you, don't hold yourself back from coming. I'll give you a lot of honor. Balak knows what Bilam's interested in. And whatever you tell me, I'll do. Just please come, curse this nation. And Bilam says what he didn't want to say initially. He says, if Balak gives me his house filled with gold and silver, which he really should, because if I don't curse them, then he could lose everything he owns. So he should really give me everything he owns, because I'm giving him everything. And if he goes to war without me, well, then he might lose everything. But if he goes to war with me, then I'll save him everything. But I'll tell you the truth. I can't go against the word of Hashem. I believe in Hashem too. I can't do anything, but stick around. I'll ask Hashem again tonight, and I'll tell you what else Hashem tells me. So, here again we see Bilam's arrogance, but we also learn a principle that shows up in Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu's servant shows up in Lavan's house. What's the first thing he says? Vayomar, Eved Avraham Anochi. I am the servant of Avraham. He puts the cards on the table. How do most people do it? They show up and they play games. Well, we could cut this deal, we could cut that deal, and only then do they tell you, I'm actually just the salesman, I have to ask the boss. He shows up and he puts the cards on the table. If there's a weakness a person has, they should put it on the table. I always tell the story. I have a very good friend who has a few issues. One issue is he's missing an arm. And when I would try to set him up, I would call up the girl and say, I have this great guy. He's a good friend of mine. He's very talented. He could play music. He could fix electronics. He's a huge Talmud Chacham. He's finished Shas I don't know how many times. And blah, 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 blah. And then I'd say, you know, there's one detail I have to mention. Now the guy is missing an arm. And then the girls would say, never mind. And a friend of mine, his wife, when she would set him up, she would call a girl and say, I want to set you up with a guy that has only one arm. Now, you'll ask, why would I want to set you up with a guy that has only one arm? Let me tell you what a wonderful person he is. But she'd begin by putting the fact on the table. And I learned from her. She set him up with girls more than once. The girls wanted to marry him, and he said no. But the brilliance of how she did it was she began with the problem. She put the problem on the table. Here's the problem. Now, let me tell you why I still think it's worth your while to meet this guy. My intuition said, do it the other way. I was wrong.
Manipulation tactics, 101. Gotta put the problems first.
So coming back to here, Bilam kept kicking the can down the road. I can't go with you. God doesn't want me to forgo my honor. All kinds of excuses until finally he has to admit, I'm going to do whatever Hashem says. Good idea. Put that in the front. Sometimes people are very comfortable playing games, making believe they're the boss. But you have a boss. Why shouldn't you say, I'm going to have to clear whatever we discuss with my boss? Arrogance. At the root of arrogance is a lie. At the root of arrogance is a person that does not have self-worth. That's one of the great weaknesses, in my humble opinion, in the current president of the United States. He is constantly busy with telling the world what he's worth, which means he doesn't really value what he's worth. He doesn't need to impress anyone. His resume is impressive enough. He's become president of the United States. You really need something more? You need to put a video up there where you punch the CNN guy in the face? Yes, because there's no limit. The way arrogance works is a person always feels like he should get more.
That's because they've been attacking you for the last 10 years.
No, that's not why. Read his book. No. That's fine. You're entitled to disagree. That's great. So let's move on. So the story...
Wait, I have a question. Is it Lashon Hara if it's not a goy?
It's a good question.
Don't say Thursday. I'll die.
No, don't do that.
In general, one is supposed to train their tongue not to speak negatively about anyone, including a non-Jew. Yes. The concept of Lashon Hara is a sensitivity that is not about harming someone else. It's about saying something that might ultimately lead to harm. And that's a special sensitivity that you only owe other people who pay membership dues to your club. You don't have to give it to people who don't pay the dues in your club. You're a Jew, they're a Jew, we're all in the same club. So one of the rules of the club is you have to have a heightened sensitivity. But it's not saying slander. It's not saying something that's hurtful to someone else. That, it doesn't matter if the person's a Jew or not. If you're going to say something that might ultimately lead to something, that the concept of the Lashon Hara, there, that's only for club members. But I don't think that Donald Trump's arrogance is something that everyone here doesn't know about. But maybe I'm wrong. Let's move on.
Just found out. Yes. You changed my opinion.
Okay.
Don't have to impress us.
We move on. So Hashem shows up to Bilam. And last time, Hashem said to Bilam, who are these fellas? Now, when Hashem asks a question, it's not because he doesn't know. But Bilam thinks, if Hashem asks me a question, then there are things he doesn't know. Well, then maybe I can get away with this. So Hashem gives us room to make mistakes, even in our perception of Him. That's a rule we see over and over again in Tanakh. When Hashem shows up to Cain and asks him, where is Hevel, your brother? Cain, where is Abel, your brother? Hashem knows the answer. The question is meant for Cain. But Cain misinterprets it. He says, ooh, he doesn't know. Maybe I'll actually get away with this. So he starts giving answers.
I'm my brother's keeper.
Right. But again, when Hashem asks questions, it's really meant for us, not for him. So this time Hashem doesn't ask him a question. He says, if these men came to call you, so go. You think you're going to get something out of it? Fine. You can go. But you're going to have to tell them what I say and put that up front. Bilam doesn't put that up front. He gets up the next morning. He saddles his aton. We'll call that a donkey, even though it probably isn't. It's some kind of animal that's similar to a donkey. And he goes with the nobles. It doesn't say chamor. It says aton. A tonne is probably a different species, not exactly a donkey. Maybe.
That sounds more right.
What? Okay.
How do you know?
I don't know. Bilam doesn't live up to his end of the deal. He makes Hashem seem dishonest. Hashem initially said no, and now Hashem said, tell them you're going to do what I say. Bilam does not tell them. So now our story begins. And we'll first learn the story the way children learn the story, and then we'll revisit the story and try to learn it as adults. So, once upon a time, there was a bad man named Bilam. And when Bilam went to curse the Jews after he knew Hashem didn't want it, so Hashem sent an angel. And the angel stood there with the sword stuck out. And Bilam didn't see the angel or the sword. His two lads, they walked straight into the sword and dropped dead. And Hashem opened the eyes of the donkey, because donkeys don't have intellect like humans. So when they see things, they don't go crazy. When a human being sees an angel, they can really go crazy. So the donkey, who does not have that intelligence, he can see things that humans don't. And just like dogs know when the angel of death comes to a city, we learn in Parashat Bo, so too the donkey sees the angel. And so the donkey goes off the path. And the angel stands there with his sword stretched out, and the donkey just went right around it. Now, Bilam doesn't know why the donkey's behaving this funny way, so he starts beating it. But he doesn't realize the donkey just saved his life. So this time, the angel's going to be smarter. So there's a path between two walls of stone. And the angel stands there with its sword stretched out. And the donkey decides she's going to squeeze just by to save Bilam's life. Boy, that angel, he should have stuck out that sword a little bit further. He would have succeeded this time. But no, he didn't. And you know what happened? The donkey saved his life a second time and broke his leg. Bashed it. So boy, did he give that donkey a beating. But we know the donkey really did a good thing, right? This time, the angel found a place that his sword fit just right and stood there with his sword stretched out. And Bilam's donkey saw that if it kept going, well then, Bilam would die. So the donkey just stopped. And Bilam couldn't understand why the donkey was doing this. So he starts beating that donkey. Poor donkey. Sasha makes a miracle. And the donkey opens its mouth and says, what did I do to you that you hit me these three times? And Bilam says, you're fooling around with me. If I had a sword here in my hand, I would have killed you right now. So all those nobles from Moab are standing there looking. Bilam behaves as though it's normal that the donkey's talking to him. The nobles are thinking he needs a sword to kill his donkey, but he could kill the whole Jewish people with his mouth. And the donkey goes on and says, I'm your donkey. Bilam says, no, I usually ride a horse. No, you've been riding on me since you were a boy. And Bilam says, and the donkey says, I've been so good to you. Even at night, I'm like your wife.
It says that.
And the nobles, Haskeni Skanti, I told you the words. So the nobles are standing there listening to this conversation, and she says, did I ever behave to you this way? And Bilam says, no. And with that, now Bilam is pretty upset. He's got a bad leg now, and the donkey's misbehaving.
He's worried about his leg.
So,
not his reputation.
His eyes open, and he sees the angel. And there's the sword. And now he sees the sword, and he sees how the donkey saved him. And this is going to be his last conversation with the donkey, because at that moment, the donkey drops dead.
Why?
Good question. And okay. And the angel.
Why did the donkey die?
I said it's a good question. We'll get to it. Wait, we're still telling the children's story of Bilam and Balak. And the angel says, Why'd you beat that donkey three times? I came out here, and I was here to veer you off the path, because he's very upset with what you're doing. And the donkey saved you the three times it veered off the path. Otherwise, you'd be dead and it would be alive. And Bilam says, so this is the way God behaves, huh? He told me I could go, and he sends an angel to tell me not to go. Did the same thing with Avram. Told him to offer a son, then sent an angel and said, no, 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 don't do it. So if you think it's a bad idea, I won't go. So the angel says, okay, you can go. But you make sure to go tell them that you're only going to say what God says to say. And that's exactly what Bilam does. When Balak goes out to greet him, Bilam says, I'm only going to do what God says. So he lives up to his promise to the angel. What's going on here? The angel couldn't have just put his sword here. The angel had to stand there and wait for Bilam to hit the sword. He couldn't just go zap. What's going on here? It's a beautiful children's story, but wait. Before we go to Maimonides' interpretation, on the basic interpretation we just went with, there has to be something else going on here. What is the angel telling him when he reveals to him, you were headed to death? He's telling him, the path you're on is headed to your destruction. I'm here to warn you again and again and again. And animals can see what you can't see. You call yourself a prophet, you're not willing to see what's really going on here. You are headed to death. You are headed to destruction. But how often in our own lives are we making the wrong moves, going down the wrong paths for the wrong reasons and refusing to see where we're headed? So Bilam has finally revealed the angel, and instead of saying, gee, I made a mistake, he says, oh, that's the game. Okay, Bilam, it's all yours. You were given your warnings.
What do the noblemen do? They're seeing this whole thing, like he's talking to nothing, and the thing opened its mouth and then dropped dead. Like,
so they walked away impressed. Look at that, he has a talking donkey.
Who is he talking to?
So one opinion is that when the donkey veered off the path, the nobles weren't there. This whole conversation took place not in front of them. So, what's going on here? Let's begin the story again.
You said you were going to tell us why the donkey died?
Yeah. Why is the donkey dead?
The poor donkey, what did it do?
It's nothing wrong.
Nothing wrong.
Itan, I need you to shift the drop for the camera. Okay. So I need you to shift a lot. All the way to there. More. More, all the way. Very good. Okay, Yeshika. So Bilam's rushing. Where's he rushing to? The question was asked earlier in the comparison between Avram and Bilam. Why is it so important that they both saddle their donkey in the morning? Well, one of the key factors in Avodat Hashem is where we ask ourselves the question, what does Hashem want? In other words, very often I can fulfill the letter of the law. I'm okay, I'm kosher, but the stories in Tanakh, with our sages' interpretation, repeatedly tell us, pay attention, what does Hashem want? It's not only a question of where's the letter of the law, it's a question of where's the will of the law, the spirit of the law. If Hashem tells the earth, produce trees, and those trees should have flavor like the fruit, and the earth says, I'll do it with one of them. So the earth gets punished for that. But what's the theme here? Very often you can interpret something in many ways and take the lazy route and say, I did mine. I did my responsibility. I fulfilled my responsibility. Your wife asks you to do the dishes. You wash all the dishes in the sink and go to sleep. Why don't you check? Maybe there are some empty pots on the fire. Maybe there are dishes on the table. Maybe there are dishes elsewhere in the house that need to be washed. What do I want to do here? Do I want to say, you asked me to wash the dishes? I did. Or do I want to do the desire of the other? Am I looking to fulfill the will? Hashem clearly tells Bilam, the nation is blessed. And Bilam is looking for the loophole. How can I do what I want? Avraham Avinu is told, can you please take Yitzchak? Hashem tells him, you don't have to. You could say no. But I'm telling you what I want. And so Avraham is given the epitome of the test, where Avraham has to say, if this is what you want, even if I have ways out, I'm going to go with it. That's not to say he didn't pray. Sure he prayed. Next week on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, we will say, Mishana et Avraham Avinu, he who answered Avraham Avinu's prayers should answer our prayers. You see, Avraham Avinu prayed that he should not have to sacrifice Yitzchak, and his prayers were answered. So he prayed about it, but he was fully prepared to do what Hashem wanted. Bilam is working out of his starting point is, what do I want? They asked the Magid Miduvna, why are your allegories so successful? So he said, I'll explain. There was once a man who was walking in the forest. And when he walked in the forest, he saw arrows shot into trees, and they were exactly on target. Every arrow was in the center of the target. You'd see the little round hole, and a bigger hole, and a bigger hole, and a bigger hole, and every arrow was in the center hole, in the center of the center hole. And so he continues going arrow after arrow after arrow until he meets the man with the bow and arrow, and he says, sir, how do you shoot your bow and arrow so well? And the man says, it's simple. I shoot my arrow, and after the arrow hits a tree, I walk over to that tree and I paint around the arrow. I paint the targets. I always paint the dead center. The Magid Miduvna said, that's how my allegories are. I begin by figuring out what message I want to get across. Once I know where I want to hit the target, then I build the allegory around the message. I'm not taking some story and matching it to my message. I figure out the message and I match the and I create the story around that.
What's his name?
The Magid Miduvna? I don't remember his name. Wherever we have to make decisions, it's a question of, what's my target? What gets painted around? If I begin by saying the will of Hashem is the center of the target, now let's paint everything else around it, so then I'm hitting dead center. If I begin by saying, well, what do I want? Let me see how I could fit Hashem into the picture. So then the center of my target is what I want. Bilam says, I know what I want. I want money, I want fame, I want recognition. So now Hashem says this and Hashem says that. Let me see how I could work out Hashem's commandments to fit my will. We are striving to do the will of Hashem. That's not where Bilam is holding. So the donkey starts riding, and there's a sword there. Bilam, you're headed to death. The donkey goes off the path, but Bilam wants to go on the path. Bilam, where do you want to go? And Bilam doesn't get the hint. What is that wall that he broke his leg on? I have one question. We can continue with this level of depth, but then we will have to do the second part of the parasha on Thursday night. I want to take a quick vote. Should we work to finish the parasha with less depth and then we'll finish it tonight? Or should we continue on this level and continue with the Rambam and go slowly and then we'll do the second half on Thursday night?
Are you here all night?
This Thursday, theoretically, I'm not here all night, but I want to see what your guys' schedule is, and it might be a late night this week.
If you are all night, then we could do whatever.
No, so what's the vote? How many people want to finish now?
Which way lets us find out why the donkey?
You guys want to finish now? Okay. So we will charge forward. What? They're all voting to finish now.
Finish now.
Okay, so we move forward. I'm going with the vote. So Bilam shows up to the city. Balak comes out to greet him. And Bilam lays the facts on the ground. He says, I can only do what Hashem says. Bilam goes with Balak. and Balak bring sacrifices. Bilam says, if you work to bring the sacrifices, so then maybe that will arouse Hashem to listen to our prayers to curse Israel. Here we learn the importance of doing things with our own hands. When we sweat doing a mitzvah, then it has much more weight. And that's why Bilam tells Balak, you're the king, don't give it to one of your servants. You bring 7 sacrifices. And he does.
It's really expensive. Didn't he know the outcome?
I guess not. So, 7 sacrifices correspond to the 7 great prophets that lived in the world from the beginning of time till that time. And 7 corresponds to the 7 nations of Israel. So, he brings 7 sacrifices and Bilam goes out. And Bilam goes out. Who are the 7 leaders, right? Adam, Hevel, Noach, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe. And Bilam goes out and he gets his first prophecy. He's walking with a limp. His leg is broken. And Hashem appears to him and he comes back and says, I was summoned here from Aramean territory by Balak, the king of Moab. He summoned me from the mountains of the east and tells me, I want you to curse out Jacob. I want you to arouse God's anger against Israel. How could I curse? God hasn't cursed. Here we learn the concept that blessings and curses can only touch one who is deserving of them. That's what the Chafetz Chaim said. A blessing isn't like giving a person a gift. Here's $100. A blessing is we take what the person has and we make it flourish. That's what a guy came to the Rebbe and said, I want a blessing to be wealthy. So the Rebbe asked him, what do you do for a living? He says, I carry boxes. So the Rebbe said, you want a blessing, you should have many boxes to carry. In other words, if you want a blessing, you have to have potential for the blessing to flourish. Invest in something. Find a way to have potential for blessing. Bilam says, I can't curse if God hasn't cursed. And so, if Hashem isn't angry at them, then there's nothing I can do to harm them. If I can catch the moment of Hashem's anger, then I could take it and apply it somewhere. These days, Hashem's not angry. I see these people of Israel, and I see that they're strong as the mountaintops, as the powerful rocks. They have great patriarchs and matriarchs. Their roots are powerful. We have to know that in life, it's not only a question of our own strength, it's a question of the strength we stand on. They are a nation that can stand alone. They have forefathers and merits that give them the power that they need no other nation. They have tremendous self-worth and self-existence and self-sustenance. They don't count among the nations. Nations will come and go. Israel will stay forever. How do you want me to talk about a nation like this? Yaakov, even in their children, is huge. Their largest number is their children. They're like the dust, those children. They never got counted. Even when the Jewish people are counted for the army, the children are never counted. Who can count the Jewish people with all their mitzvos? I wish I die a death like them who lead such honest lives. I wish my end should be like theirs. Balak says to Bilam, what'd you do? I brought you here to curse my enemies. You're blessing them. He says, I say what God tells me to say, nothing else. Balak says, let me take you somewhere else. You'll see the edge. At least you won't see all of them. You'll curse them out from there. So he takes them to a high place where the guards used to look out, an outpost to look out. And he says, I want you to see what's going to be here. That's the place where Balak foresaw that Moshe would die. So he said, if Moshe will ultimately die here, this is a great place to curse the Jewish people. They set up, Balak was a sorcerer, yeah. So they say, he brings 7 sacrifices. Balak tells him, stand by your sacrifice, and I'm going to go and ask Hashem for prophecy. Hashem appears a second time to Bilam. Tells him, go back to Balak and say the following. He shows up and Balak mocks him. He says, what God say now? Which was a way of saying, I understand you have no control over what you're going to say. So Bilam gets annoyed at him and he starts his prophecy. And he says, Stand up, Balak. He's talking to the king. Stand up, Balak, and listen. I'm going to give you my testimony, son of Tzipor. God is not like a human who lies. God is not like a human who changes his mind. You think God said something and he won't do it? You think God said something he won't keep to it? God has chosen to bless Israel, and he will continue blessing, and there's no turning him back. God sees nothing wrong with the Jewish people. There's not a single Jew who worships idols. God sees nothing wrong with the Jewish people. They have done no transgressions that he should be upset at them. Bilam over here is telling Balak another thing. He says, even when they do something wrong, Hashem lets it ride. He says, in general, they're good. He's not so careful with anything a Jew does wrong. He says, let it ride. In general, they're good people. Hashem, their God, is with them even when they do things wrong. Utuat melech bo. Tuat melech, one interpretation is, they have the friendship, like the word rea, friendship of the king is with them. The other interpretation is, they can blow shofar and anoint Hashem as their king. Truat melech bo. Here we see that blowing shofar, which is called trua, also reflects friendship, a connection with Hashem. Hashem is the powerful one who took them out of Egypt. You spoke about their exodus as though it's a coincidence. There's no coincidence there. Hashem with his power took them out, and Hashem has extraordinary power. The Jewish people are extraordinary. They deserve blessings because they don't use sorcerers like me and you, Balak. They don't need sorcerers. They have real prophets. Now here, Bilam is referring to another human weakness. The human being always wants to know what's happening next. What will happen? We're always curious to figure out the future on our personal life, on the global scale. That's why people go to sorcerers. When you believe Hashem is running the show, then you say, even if I don't know, I'm in good hands. So Bilam says, let me tell you now what God's done on their behalf. All this time since I've come here, Hashem doesn't allow his anger to be expressed so that I won't be able to hang on to it and curse them. They are a nation that gets up like lions. A Jew opens his eyes. He says, Modani, I thank you, Hashem. He gets out of bed. He puts on his tzitzis. He has another mitzvah. He starts his day. He puts on his tefillin. He hasn't yet eaten breakfast. He says, Shema Yisrael. They're like lions. They just get out of bed and they consume mitzvah after mitzvah after mitzvah. Of course they're strong like lions. They don't go to bed at night before they say so many mitzvos, like kriyat shema, like benching after they eat. No one can harm them. Even demons can't touch them. Dam chalalim yishte. He says, they will drink the blood of the corpses, which was his way of saying the Jews will ultimately wipe out all the armies of the Midianites. There's going to be an end game for Midianites. Balak says to Bilam, you know, if you're not going to curse them, at least don't bless them. Bilam says, I told you, I'm going to say whatever God says. Balak tells Bilam, let me take you somewhere else. Maybe here Hashem will see it fit to curse them. And he takes them to Peor. And he saw that the Jewish people would, at the end of our parasha, be enticed to serve Peor. The Midianite women will show up and lie there in their tents. And the scene is, Bilam, his final advice to Balak will be, if you want to make them full, the Jews are hungry, the Jews are thirsty, they're eating mun all the time, you could get them that way. And so what Balak does is he sends a whole army of thousands of old ladies with tents.
Old ladies.
And they sit outside the tents and they're selling wine. And they have these tents set up behind them. And what the Jews see when they leave their camp is a bunch of tsanua, completely clad, old ladies selling wine. And they go out, the young men, to buy wine. And the lady says, if you want, you don't have to buy without tasting. Have a cup. And they offered them cups of wine to drink. And the young men would drink a cup of wine, which was very powerful. And the old lady would say, if you like that, I have something much better inside the tent. Go help yourself. They'd go inside the tent, which was very dimly lit, and they'd stand in there for a second, and they'd see a cup being held out to them. As their eyes got used to the dim lighting inside the tent, they saw a bed, and a Midianite girl lying on that bed without clothing, holding the cup for him and saying, "Have a drink." So he stands there. And in the corner, there's like a little potty. And he takes the cup of wine from him. And he drinks the cup of wine. Now he's had two cups of wine. And there's a lady there on the bed. And he asks, "What are you doing here?" And she says, "I'm waiting for you." And then as he approaches her and he's ready to transgress with her, she says, "One thing, just go to the bathroom there in front of my idol called Peor." And the Jew thinks, going to the bathroom in front of an idol can't be too bad. But the lady just told him, "That's how I want you to worship my idol." So the Jew thinks, "Well, I'm defecating near the idol. Can't be such a bad thing." But that was the way they worshiped Baal Peor. So right after defecating in front of Baal Peor, he continues and transgresses with this lady. So 24,000 men die. There's a plague that hits the people. But these people, these Midianites, were purposely setting this all up to make the Jews fool. And they're going to pay. We're going to destroy all of Midian after this. But no, Yeshua, Pinchas will. So coming back to our parsha, so Balak sees that Peor is an area where the Jews will have a downfall. He's right. And he says, "Come, why don't you curse them from there?" So Bilam decides, "Let me look out to the desert and I'll think about how the Jewish people worship the golden calf, and I'll curse them from there." Bilam looks at the desert, and then he looks at the Jews, and he sees something extraordinary. He says, "Matovu o'alecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, Jacob? You're all careful that your windows and your doors are in different directions so that when a Jew looks out his window, he won't peek into the next Jew's tent. The way you set up your camp reflects an internal piety, an internal tzniut. You're all careful to be modest with regards to your neighbor. Let me be careful not to see into my neighbor's house. Matovu o'alecha Yaakov. I once had the good fortune to rent to be a roommate with yeshiva guys in a yeshiva in Manhattan. So our building was one of these small buildings in Manhattan with only like 30 floors. And we were like 5-6 flights up. And next to us were a bunch of other buildings. So I came into the room and I saw that the windows were covered like with a black cardboard. So the lower window, meaning you had the lower window and the upper window, the lower window was covered with black cardboard. So I couldn't figure out why it was. And I thought that it was there for shade. So when the guy who was in that bed left and I got the bed near the window, I said, "That's a nasty thing to always look at a black cardboard. Let me take off that black cardboard and I'll have light in the room." I took off the black cardboard. And then I realized why he had black cardboard there. Because from that room, you could look down into about 150 different people's apartments. Because you could just look down from the fifth floor to all the apartments beneath you. And you could see into those apartments. So, Matovu Alecha Yaakov. Jacob is careful not to look into other people's tents. And that's why when Bilam sees that, he says, "That's amazing. Of course the Jewish people have the Shekhinah in their presence. Even when our temple is destroyed, it is called Mishkan, a place of the Ribon Shalom, a place of Hashem. Kinchalim nitayu, we are like streams. We have continuance, like a stream that has constant flow. We are like a garden that grows by the stream that has constant irrigation. We are like the beautiful blossoming ohalim, the perfumes that Hashem plants. They're like the cedars by the water. They grow tall." And so Bilam says they will grow. They will become greater than Agog. They will ultimately take down their nemesis, the Amaleki people. Hashem, who took them out of Egypt, will lead them to destroy nation after nation. They will destroy the arrows of the nations who shoot against them. Whoever blesses them should be blessed. Whoever curses them should be cursed. Balak gets upset. He claps his hands and he says, I brought you here to curse them. Now you've blessed them three times. Run away. Go back to your place. I want to give you so much honor. And now Hashem has just held you back from that honor. Balaam says, but I told your messengers that you could give me all the money in the world. I'm not going to transgress what Hashem says. And now I'm going back home. Let me give you some advice. Our sages say that was the advice we learned about earlier. Let me tell you what's yet to come. He says, I know what Hashem is thinking. I'm telling you what's yet to come. There will be a star from Jacob. This is the pasuk about Mashiach. This is the pasuk where a segment of Nachmanides' debate with the Jew who became an apostate, who wanted to convert the Jews to Christianity. A Jew who denies his religion. So Nachmanides and he had a part of their debate just on this pasuk. What does it mean, a star will come down from Jacob? Our tradition is this refers to Mashiach. The question is, who is it referring to? There will be new leadership from Israel. And that leadership will take down the leaders of Moab, and all of mankind will be ruled by that leadership. And they will take over Edom and Seir and all the enemies of Israel. Israel will see continued success. And there will be another ruler from Yaakov. He doesn't tell us who these two are. There will be one who will do all this. Then there'll be another ruler from Yaakov. And he will take down the great leader of the greatest city, the greatest capital of that time. And he doesn't tell us who that is. So our tradition is we're talking about two great leaders, the last one being the Mashiach. And then he saw Amalek and he said, they are the first of the enemies. They're the ones who led enemies against Israel. And they will ultimately be lost like everyone else. He saw Yisro and he says, how lucky you are that you joined Israel. He says, who's going to live to see that time when all of this will come to be? And then he goes back home. And Balak goes his way. And what Bilam and Balak couldn't do, what the sword couldn't do and the curses couldn't do, the women could do. And this is a recurring theme in our lives. The great human weakness, that desire for promiscuity, that great weakness which began with drinking a cup of wine, which is why at that point they made an institution, as we will learn next week, that Jews don't drink wine with non-Jews. They said, look where it led to. And so they saw the men going out with the Midianite women. And if it began one way, it evolved another way, where the princess of Midian comes in and she's so fat, she's as wide as this room, the Talmud says, which is an exaggeration. In those days, the fatter a person was, the more beautiful they were considered. So when the Talmud wants to tell us she was a real beauty, the Talmud says she was a half a mile wide. What the Talmud means to say is she was the most beautiful woman of the time. In their days, that's how you describe beauty. So the Talmud says she was gorgeous, and her father, the king of Tzor, Chur, he tells her, Vatsur, he tells her, don't go for anyone but the leader. You take down Moshe. So she comes in with her locks of hair, and she says, I'm looking for the leader. Well, the tribe of Shimon, they were getting nervous because Moshe established courts and he said, we're going to judge the people for what they're doing wrong. And the tribe of Shimon were major offenders in this transgression. So they run to their leader, Zimri, and they say, save us. So Zimri goes over to her and he says, beauty, what are you doing here? And she says, I'm looking for the leader. So he says, I'm the leader. So she says, I'm looking for the great leader. He says, I'm a great leader, come with me. And he grabs her by her locks of hair, and he brings her before Moshe and the courts, and he says, she's Midianite, Moshe. You married a Midianite. If you want to tell all my men that they're doing something wrong, who allowed you to marry a Midianite? As though she didn't convert, as though Moshe's wife was the same as this lady. And then he takes her publicly up to a tent where everyone can see him. And he takes her into the tent, and everyone could hear what's going on in the tent. And he goes on and on with her. The Talmud says they were intimate once, and then again, and then again, and then again. And everyone's watching. And his whole tribe, this is taking a few minutes now, his whole tribe is standing their guard with their weapons. Meaning if Moshe wants to do something, civil war is about to erupt, and we're out of time. We'll pick up next week.
Well, you can't stop right there.
Okay. Say there. So Moshe and Aaron and Pinchas are standing there, and they start calling out. What are they going to say? They yell out and they start saying, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. They're yelling Shema. Can you guys wake up to your senses? There's one God, and you guys are going against Him. So the best way they can express it is they're standing there crying. Moshe and Aaron, as they yell out the Shema. Pinchas sees all this, and he runs up to Moshe, and he says, Moshe, you taught us that if a man publicly goes with a non-Jewish woman, then you're supposed to kill him and the woman at that moment, that they're being intimate. They're still being intimate in that tent. Everyone knows it. So Moshe says, you're right, I forgot. You're right. Pinchas says, but you said a person has to be a zealot. Am I pure enough? Am I qualified? Can I do it? Moshe says, you can do it. So Pinchas says, okay. Now, Pinchas has a goal. How is he going to do it? So Pinchas takes his staff, and he has a blade. He puts the blade in his pocket. He screws out the blade from his staff. He puts it in his pocket, and he starts limping over to the tribe of Shimon. And he's hobbling over. And the tribe of Shimon says, what you doing? And he says, I want a piece of the action too. I heard there are beautiful girls in there. Can't I have some too? So they say, clear the path. He's a Kohen. He's joining us. Let him in. So Pinchas hobbles in. And as he approaches the tent, he can hear, he can see that they're still being intimate. So at that point, he reaches into his pocket and takes out the blade and screws it onto his staff and then runs and charges the tent. And he charges the tent with his staff and the blade sticking out and goes straight through the tent and into the maleness and femaleness of the two that are interlocked and stabs straight through them and lifts them up. Like, you know, like, what do they call it? Shish kebab? What do they call it? On the stick? When you have on the stick pieces of meat, one on the other? That's what's called shish kebab? So the Medrash says that he was so powerful that he charged the tent, pierced through both of them, and on his arm, what an arm, he lifted both of them and kept running. So he was fast and powerful.
She said she was fat.
Yeah, okay, he was powerful, yeah. She was. The Medrash says she was very wide. So he lifts them both. All of Israel sees the two of them on his sword, you know, sliding down. Everyone sees, and he raises the sword, like he raises both of them, and they come sliding down dead. And now the tribe of Shimon is ready to kill him. A plague has broken out. People are falling like flies. The tribe of Shimon are brandishing their swords. And this is where the parasha ends. Next week's parasha begins with the tribe of Shimon ready to kill Pinchas. Who does he think he is? He just killed the leader of Israel. His grandfather was an idol worshiper too. He's a descendant of Jethro. Yisro, his great-grandfather, was a pagan. He was a priest for idol worship. The tribe of Shimon is ready to kill Pinchas. Pinchas has risked his life, and now he's in danger. And that's where the parasha ends. The plague stops. 24,000 people are dead. The tribe of Shimon is very upset, and Pinchas is standing on the side in danger. To be continued next week.